lifting talks with the P4+1 group of countries, Iran has made its stance clear, from sanctions removal to the U.S. assuring and guaranteeing that it won't pull out of the deal again. But the U.S. has not given any assurances on neither, even though talks are set to resume on November 29. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at whether these talks are doomed to fail and whether it has any chances of success.
Iran's nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, has been in the spotlight for quite some time now, after the U.S. in May 2018 unilaterally withdrew from it and reinstated sanctions on the Islamic Republic. In recent months, all eyes have been on Iran to see what approach it takes over the JCPOA after the country's new administration, led by President Ebrahim Raisi, came to power in August.
We support the negotiations that guarantee our national interests, but Iran will not tie its economy and the lives of its people to the negotiations, nor will it allow negotiations for the sake of negotiations. We will not let the negotiations become attritional.
When the administration of President Joe Biden took office in January, Iran and the remaining parties to the JCPOA held six rounds of talks in the Austrian capital before they were suspended in June due to Washington's failure to remove the sanctions. The U.S. and its Western allies exerted pressure on Iran over the past months to resume the talks, but Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian said Iran will first review the previous Vienna negotiations and then start talks with Russia, China, the U.K., France and Germany, known as the P4+1 group. Just last week, Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Bagheri Kani said Iran and the EU agreed that Tehran and the P4+1 start talks on November 29th. He stressed that the talks should result in the removal of sanctions on Iran. The terminology that the Iranian official has used for the upcoming talks attaches significance to Tehran's approach towards the JCPOA. The term start conveys the message that Iran seeks to begin result-oriented negotiations. Talks with the aim of removing sanctions indicates that the revival of the JCPOA and the U.S. return to the deal is not of substantial importance to Iran. What matters is the removal of all sanctions under various titles in action and not on paper. The U.S. has been trying to push Iran to succumb to its demands via the so-called maximum pressure campaign that was launched by the Trump administration following its unilateral JCPOA pullout. But such a pressure campaign has backfired, since Iran has strengthened its defense capabilities, advanced its nuclear program, and begun to enrich uranium to the 60% level. Now, the ball is in the court of the U.S. and its Western allies. They should decide before November 29th on whether they want to take a lesson from the so-called maximum pressure campaign, which top White House officials have explicitly branded as a failed policy, or go on with their anti-Iran agenda. The new Iranian government believes that national interests will be achieved by increasing the country's power. What is certain for now is that the speed of Iran's enrichment shows that the country will not accept restrictions on its nuclear activities in case of non-compliance by the United States.
Well, guest joining us for this edition of The Spotlight, journalist, political analyst, and author Daniel Lazar joins us from New York. Also joining us, political analyst and professor of American Studies at the Faculty of World Studies at the University of Tehran, Fuad Azadi.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome you both. With Zadi, I'm going to start with you, and perhaps I'm going to set the tempo to this spotlight program from a quote from the head of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, who has said, quote, "The U.S. president, lacking authority, is not ready to give guarantees. If the current status quo continues, the result of the negotiations is clear." Tell us what he means by that.
Well, he basically is talking about one of the difficulties that exist in the negotiations that happened in Vienna, the six rounds of negotiations. And the problem was that the Iranian side was saying that if we reach an agreement, how would we know whether the current administration, the Biden administration, or the next administration will actually stay in the agreement? That's a legitimate question, because we had the Trump administration decided to leave the agreement after Iran had done what Iran needed to do under the agreement. So the Obama administration got all the concessions that they wanted from Iran, and then they then many of the things that they were supposed to do under the agreement, and then you had the Trump administration that left the agreement altogether. So it's a legitimate question on the Iranian side whether this is going to happen again, because as they say in the United States, if you fool me once, shame on you. If you fool me twice, shame on me. And Iranians are not fooled, so they don't want to face similar situation that they experienced during the Trump administration, given the fact that Biden may not run in 2024, given his difficulties. And Trump is gaining popularity. So he may run again, he may become president, or some other Trump crony like Mike Pompeo may run and get elected. So that's the basic question that Iran has. That if we go back to the agreement, do get rid of all the advances that Iran has made, follow the spirit and the letter of the agreement the way Iran did in 2015 until 2018, how would we know if the other side would do their part, or whether they will just leave the agreement? That's a question that Iran has. The answer that the Biden administration gives is we don't know. They're not giving any guarantees for the next administration. They're not even giving any guarantees for their own administration, citing the U.S. Congress, citing other excuses. So when Mr. Shamkhani talks about the U.S. president that doesn't have any authority, that's what he basically is talking about. That the U.S. president cannot do anything to for the other side, for the Iranian side, to believe that they're actually going to follow the agreement.
Sure. Well, Daniel Azar, we're also looking, I mean, in one respect, what Dr. Azadi said there about perhaps Trump running and maybe him or somebody else winning, like Pompeo, would lead to maybe the U.S. pulling out of the deal. But we're looking at also at current responses coming, like from Senator Ted Cruz, a Republican who he recently tweeted about this Iran deal, said it is a 100% certainty that any future Republican president will tear it up. So when you have that kind of statement coming, doesn't Iran have a right to then have a question mark when it comes to this deal actually sticking and then wanting a guarantee on it?
Well, I must say the Americans, and I include myself among them, are a bit puzzled by this Iranian response, because it's axiomatic that a new president will have the power. He's not bound by any previous administration. If he wants to abandon a treaty, he's free to do so. If the UN wanted to walk out of if the U.S. wanted to walk out of the UN tomorrow, it could do so. If Trump wants to do it 4 years from now, there's nothing to stop him. But I think the real issue is that I don't think there's any chance that Biden will re-enter the agreement. Biden is increasingly weak. His poll ratings are plummeting. He's very unpopular. His performance is incompetent in office. I think it's clear, it's increasingly clear the Republicans will regain the White House in 2024. And meantime, Biden just shows no interest in a serious approach to the negotiations in Vienna. He won't do anything to reduce sanctions or much less eliminate them. And the official U.S. position is to make additional demands on Iran, which have nothing to do with the nuclear accord, and the U.S. is insisting that Iran agree to these demands as a precondition for re-entering the 2015 agreement. So the U.S. position is impossible from the outset, and I have from the start I have been completely pessimistic about any chances of a Biden administration re-entering that agreement. I've been saying that since before there was a Biden administration, and when Joe Biden was only a candidate, was still running on the campaign trail. I argued then, and I argue now, that there is simply no chance of the U.S. re-entering that agreement.
Yeah, and that's true. And Fuadizadi, that is the case when it comes to what our guest has said in terms of him being insistent and very pessimistic about this actually happening. But there's a question mark here, Fuadizadi. I don't know if you can answer this or not. And that is both sides know, at least Iran knows. I shouldn't say both sides. Iran knows what it needs. Iran knows what it wants. Iran has voiced what it wants. So before the negotiations start, Iran's stance, at least, is very clear. Given the fact that the U.S. knows that, and given the fact that there's going to be talks, does that mean that there's a chance of success? Because if there wasn't, and Iran has relayed its stance, then why would the U.S. want to start negotiations, in direct negotiations, I should say, through the P4 plus one for sanctions lifting?
I don't think the U.S. is interested in negotiating with Iran to lift sanctions. They like sanctions. They have an addiction to sanctions. They are sanctioning over 30 countries as we speak. It's part of the U.S. government foreign policy to sanction people that don't agree with U.S. domination, whether in their own countries or elsewhere. They are negotiating with Iran because they like JCPOA, but they like JCPOA when Iran does what Iran is supposed to do. And they don't like JCPOA when they are supposed to do their part. So they very much speak about JCPOA in terms that are quite strong. They like it, but they like it when Iran implements it. Another reason they are interested in Vienna talks is to create a consensus among P4 plus one countries, the Europeans plus Russia and China, to basically create a united front against Iran. That's the basic idea. The Europeans generally follow U.S. foreign policy, particularly when there is a strong demand from the United States. That's what they have done since World War II. And the hope of the U.S. government is to at least make Russia and China stay quiet and go along with whatever U.S. and Europeans are designing to do. That's the basic idea. And then there's a lot of propaganda involved. So yesterday, when Jake Sullivan was talking to the U.S. media, he says that we are ready to go back whenever Iran dies. But that basically gives them a talking point. Biden, during his campaign, talked about returning to the nuclear agreement, and he could do so on the first day that he became president, the same day he returned to the Paris Accord. And the reason he hasn't done that is because of what's going on inside the U.S. government and the pressure that the U.S. government is getting from the Israelis and the Saudis and the Israeli lobby and people like that.
Can you please expand for us more about that, what our guest Sarfoud Ezzati said, Daniel Azar, about Israel, Israeli lobby, and what they're doing within the U.S. administration?
Yeah, first of all, I agreed with every single word your other guest uttered, and he's completely correct. And the U.S. is under intense pressure from Israel and the Saudis. And as we know, I mean, Israel, has huge power in Washington, and it has, the Saudis have economic influence. The Israelis have huge amounts of political and ideological influence, and that is really quite decisive. It's not to say that Biden is a tool of the Israelis 100% of the time, but let's just say he's a tool of the Israelis 95% of the time. And so the Israelis are putting intense pressure on the White House not to re-enter the JCPOA. They are calling all their allies into the fight. And Biden is just extremely unlikely to buck that pressure, especially now that his polls are plummeting. He's increasingly unpopular, and therefore he's very weak.
We got to look at different aspects of the sanctions lifting talks with the P4+1, and looking at what may happen and how the response should come from the U.S. side when it comes to, for example, the sanctions being lifted. What is it that the other side needs to do, and in particular the U.S.? Thing they need to do, as one analyst has stated, is to offer speedy relief from these sanctions, but also find a mechanism to reassure the rest of the world and financial institutions that it's okay to do business with Iran. Now, my question to you is, when the deal was signed back in 2015, originally, and everything was okay then, the U.S. still went around and said, don't do business with Iran, and it still promoted an air of doubt for anybody, company-wise or country-wise, to do business with Iran. How can they reassure Iran of that this time around if things were to go in a positive direction?
Well, it's not really complicated. If the United States wanted to return to the agreement, they could return to the agreement. They could do it. Biden could do it on the first day of his presidency, could do it today. And by returning to the agreement, it means that they would implement sanctions relief sections of the agreement. Because after all, it was the Trump administration that caused all these difficulties by leaving the agreement. And then the Biden administration people who were not in the government at that time criticized Trump for doing so. So if the Biden administration wanted to return to the agreement, they can do it today. But they're not doing that. They're not lifting sanctions. They're actually putting more sanctions on Iran. They used to say that Iran wants to build a nuclear weapon. About 10 days ago, Antony Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State, issued a statement sanctioning people in Iran and companies in Iran that are building drones that are, as you know, they're not weapons of mass destruction. So once Iran gave a lot of concessions on its nuclear, peaceful nuclear program, it seems they like that, and now they want concessions on other military equipment in Iran that have nothing to do with weapons of mass destruction. So that's the basic problem that Iran has, that no matter what you give the United States, you come back and want more. And this is what Mindy Sherman, who is now Under Secretary of State and during the Obama administration was the lead negotiator on the U.S. side, said a few months ago in the U.S. Congress that 2021 is not 2015. And by that, what she means is that in 2015, we had some concerns, and we got a nuclear agreement, and those concerns went away. Now, in 2021, they want new things from Iran. That's what she basically implies. And you put yourself on the side of the Iranian government, and you realize that last time you signed an agreement with the United States, they didn't do what they were supposed to do, and they left. And this time, they want more concessions without doing the things that they were supposed to do in 2015 and later on. So that's why you see a lot of hesitations in Tehran. They're going to Vienna for talks, but as you mentioned in the tweet of Iran's National Security Council Secretary, that they're not very optimistic about the United States because you know how the U.S. government behaves. So that's quite clear
to them. Okay. Thank you very much. Well, unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. We'll have to end it there. Let me thank our guest, journalist, political analyst, and author, Daniel Lazar from New York. A pleasure for your contribution there. And Dr. Fouad Azadi, thank you so much, political analyst and professor of American Studies at the Faculty of World Studies at the University of Tehran. Thank you so much. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From the Covered Halfway and the entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Suratul Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful. But those whose scales are light, those are the ones who have lost their souls, being in hell, abiding eternally.
Brothers and sisters, in the previous program, we talked about the 102nd verse of chapter Mu'minun, فَمَنْ ثَقُلَتْ مَوَازِينُهُ فَأُولَٰئِكَ هُمُ الْمُفْلِحُونَ. Whoever's scale be heavy, they are the ones who shall be prosperous. But in the previous program, we said that for every task, there is a measure. And as a result, the next verse implies that those whose scale of their deeds is light because of lacking faith, because of lacking of righteous deeds, they are the ones who have lost the capital of their own selves and are the real losers because they will abide in hell forever. The 103rd verse says, وَمَنْ خَفَّتْ مَوَازِينُهُ فَأُولَٰئِكَ الَّذِينَ خَسِرُوا أَنفُسَهُمْ فِي جَهَنَّمَ خَالِدُونَ. And whoever's scale be light, they are they who have ruined their souls. In hell, they will abide. Now, the very first thing that comes into our mind, the very first question, is the term خَسِرُوا أَنفُسَهُمْ. They have lost their souls. This, the use of this sentence in the verse is a subtle reference to the fact that they have lost their greatest capital. What was their greatest capital? It was their existence in the marketplace of this world, and they did not obtain anything valuable for it. Because in the previous verse, the Holy Quran said, فَمَنْ ثَقُلَتْ مَوَازِينُهُ فَأُولَٰئِكَ هُمُ الْمُفْلِحُونَ. The prosperous ones are the ones whose scale are heavy, and we have to make the most of this world. Now, by talking about this verse as well, we understand the meaning of the word mawazin better. It was, as you may remember, the plural form of mizan, which was a scale. And of course, it had a very vast meaning enveloping all means of measurement.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
Now, the word mizan is plural, so it envelops all kinds of deeds, be it light or heavy, be it small or big. be it with the right intention or the false one. So we have mawazin for every kind of deed. So if you have heavy scales, you will be prosperous. And if you have light scales, you have ruined your souls. So you have nothing prepared for your next life. And this is when you understand that فَأُولَٰئِكَ الَّذِينَ خَسِرُوا أَنفُسَهُمْ, they are the ones who have ruined their souls. What is the true meaning of ruining your souls? Means you have lost this chance and you did not use your greatest capital, which was this world at your disposal. You did not see the world as a means of reaching prosperity in the next life. And this is the true meaning of فَأُولَٰئِكَ الَّذِينَ خَسِرُوا أَنفُسَهُمْ, they are the ones who have lost their souls. Now, also, the meaning of the word mawazin would be more clear if we take a look back at the previous verses. For example, in the 101st verse of the chapter, we read فَإِذَا نُفِخَ فِي الصُّورِ فَلَا أَنْسَبَ بَيْنَهُمْ يَوْمَئِذٍ, and when the trumpet is blown, there will be no relationship between them. On the day of resurrection, on that day, there will be no help for us except our deeds. There will be no relationships with the powerful families of the world. And the only criterion on that day is the mizan, or better say, the lightness or heaviness of mizan. What you could use in the world is not used in this aspect of life, is not used in the day of resurrection, and you are left with your actions and deeds alone. And that is why we read in the previous verses that everybody is running from each other, even from their own families. And that's when they understand that their biggest regret is that they have not used this world as a means of reaching prosperity. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith
follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Erubashavet, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes.
Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
There will be no trial, charges, or even a disciplinary hearing for two police officers involved in killing an 80-year-old woman inside her home with a tear gas grenade. It's the latest example of French cops hurting citizens and not facing even minor consequences. At the start of the Yellow Vest movement in 2018, police were clashing with protesters in the Mediterranean city of Marseille. Algerian national Zineb Redouane was in her fourth-floor apartment trying to close her shutters when she was shot and killed. Redouane was on the phone with her daughter at the time of the incident, and she reportedly said, quote, "He targeted me. The police targeted me. I made eye contact with two policemen. One fired at me. Then they got in their car and left," end quote. She died the next day from her injuries.
Et aujourd'hui?
We have suffered repression, which no president has ever permitted in the history of this country. We are not at war. We are not enemies. But the government has waged war against us simply because we oppose their decisions. Just for that, many have paid dearly.
For months, the Interior Minister falsely claimed that the death had nothing to do with the grenade and that she died of cardiac arrest. Half of Redouane's face was collapsed in by the grenade, and she inhaled large amounts of tear gas.
On a subi une répression.
The government has not given one word of apology or one moment of compassion towards any victims of police brutality during the Yellow Vest era. Also, there has not been one word of condemnation for the police who have committed these acts. None of the police have been convicted, even though people have been blinded, crippled, and lost. Of course, our heart goes out to the grieving family, and the Yellow Vest will continue to remember Zainab Redouane and to demand justice.
Her family has sued the Interior Minister and other senior officials for concealing and interfering with evidence. A ballistics investigation by the NGO Disclose suggested that police fired directly at Redouane's window.
Many wonder if there might have been some admission of wrongdoing if the victim wasn't Arab. That appears likely, but she also joins a Yellow Vest-related casualty list, which includes 5,000 people seriously hurt, 1,000 critically injured, scores maimed for life, and 11 other deaths. Amin Mazahari, Paris.
Meet Miqdad Kawasmeh, a Palestinian prisoner held in an Israeli jail without charge or trial under the regime's so-called administrative detention policy. He's among the six inmates who went on hunger strike in protest of their indefinite imprisonment weeks ago. Sunday marked the 109th day since he last ate. Israeli medics forcibly injected him with nutrients on the 92nd day of its strike. Other hunger strikers are Kayed Al-Fasfus, Ala Arraj, Hisham Abu Hawash, Ayad Huraimi, and Luay Al-Ashkar. The hunger strikers, particularly Fasfus and Kawasmeh, are grappling with deteriorating health conditions, with Palestinian officials warning that the inmates are at immediate risk of death. On Sunday, over 4,500 Palestinians in different Israeli jails also rejected their meals in solidarity with the six hunger strikers. Palestinians in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip have held sit-ins and demonstrations over the past weeks demanding their immediate release. The United Nations Human Rights Commission has expressed grave concern over the lives of the prisoner. The UN body also criticized Israel's administrative detention practice, calling it a violation of international law. But no word or action is coming from Israel's powerful and influential Western allies. Experts believe the striking similarities they see with Israel to be the reason.
There is a tremendous imbalance of power in the world. And just as we see the tremendous crimes carried out by Western imperialist powers, the ongoing use of illegal sanctions, unilateral coercive measures to starve countries, invasions and occupations, the unstinting support, funding, and collaboration with the Zionist occupation of Palestine is part and parcel of those crimes.
Palestinian inmates regularly stage hunger strikes in protest at their illegal detention and harsh conditions in Israeli jail. What they're fighting for are their most basic and fundamental rights.
Iran's nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, has been in the spotlight for quite some time now, after the US, in May 2018, unilaterally withdrew from it and reinstated sanctions on the Islamic Republic. In recent months, all eyes have been on Iran to see what approach it takes over the JCPOA after the country's new administration, led by President Ebrahim Raisi, came to power in August.
We support the negotiations that guarantee our national interests, but Iran will not tie its economy and the lives of its people to the negotiations, nor will it allow negotiations for the sake of negotiations. We will not let the negotiations become attritional.
When the administration of President Joe Biden took office in January, Iran and the remaining parties to the JCPOA held six rounds of talks in the Austrian capital before they were suspended in June due to Washington's failure to remove the sanctions. The US and its Western allies exerted pressure on Iran over the past months to resume the talks, but Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian said Iran will first review the previous Vienna negotiations and then start talks with Russia, China, the UK, France and Germany, known as the P4 plus 1 group. Just last week, Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Bagheri Kani said Iran and the EU agreed that Tehran and the P4 plus 1 start talks on November 29th. He stressed that the talks should result in the removal of sanctions on Iran. The terminology that the Iranian official has used for the upcoming talks attaches significance to Tehran's approach towards the JCPOA. The term start conveys the message that Iran seeks to begin result-oriented negotiations. Talks with the aim of removing sanctions indicates that the revival of the JCPOA and the US return to the deal is not of substantial importance to Iran. What matters is the removal of all sanctions under various titles in action and not on paper. The US has been trying to push Iran to succumb to its demands via the so-called maximum pressure campaign that was launched by the Trump administration following its unilateral JCPOA pullout. But such a pressure campaign has backfired, since Iran has strengthened its defense capabilities, advanced its nuclear program, and begun to enrich uranium to the 60% level. Now, the ball is in the court of the US and its Western allies. They should decide before November 29th on whether they want to take a lesson from the so-called maximum pressure campaign, which top White House officials have explicitly branded as a failed policy, or go on with their anti-Iran agenda. The new Iranian government believes that national interests will be achieved by increasing the country's power. What is certain for now is that the speed of Iran's enrichment shows that the country will not accept restrictions on its nuclear activities in case of non-compliance by the United States.
A senior member of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Mohammed al-Houthi, has slammed the recent U.S. arms sale to Saudi Arabia, saying it confirms the contradiction in Biden's administration when it comes to Yemen. In a tweet, al-Houthi said the arms sales once again proved that the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden had no real intention to stop the support for the Saudi-led war on Yemen.
America.
The United States is leading the war on Yemen and supports the Saudi-led coalition logistically and militarily. Washington's claims that it would stop the war on Yemen are incorrect, and the evidence for that is the continuation of the U.S. support for terrorist groups across the country. And this was proved through what the Yemeni army found in Al-Qaeda weapons warehouses with USAID logos.
Observers say Biden's promises to stop the war in Yemen have been nothing but lies to gain more votes in the elections. They say the new U.S. missile sold to Riyadh will be used to bomb Yemenis and fighter jets such as F-15 and not as defensive weapons, contrary to what Washington claims.
The pre-election statements of the U.S. administration were only aimed at winning more votes, and the promises that the support for the Saudi regime and the war on Yemen would be halted were false. The U.S. administration proved that it supports the Saudi regime and that it only seeks to earn more money. The new deal is for offensive weapons. So the new U.S. administration is directly contributing to killing more Yemenis.
Saudi Arabia, with Washington's support, launched a deadly war on Yemen in March 2015. Over the years, the kingdom has used internationally prohibited weapons, including the U.S. cluster bombs, to target residential areas, according to the Cluster Ammunition Monitor.
Yemenis have long been accusing the U.S. of being the main supporter of the brutal Saudi-led war on their country. People here say they will continue to support Yemen's armed forces, as the armed struggle seems to be the only way to force Riyadh to stop its years-long war and siege. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Hundreds of anti-establishment protesters linked to the global hacktivist group Anonymous near the British Houses of Parliament under heavy police presence in a demonstration dubbed the Million Mask March.
They have a long list of grievances, from the government's performance on the climate crisis to its response to the pandemic to infringement of civil liberties, as well as its support for military intervention abroad.
It's all corruption. It's all fakery as well. They benefit from wars. We don't. We wouldn't have a war. All of these senators and everything, yeah, we care about the people of our families who have died, but none of these people would have voted for any war, any war. The governments do that, and we have to go around, you know, like, praising them up or doing what they say. No. No.
The event happens on the same date every year, the 5th of November, a date associated with an attempted attack on Parliament in 1605. But instead of the traditional burning of an effigy of one of the culprits by the name of Guy Fawkes and a bonfire each year, the group don masks made popular by the novel and movie V for Vendetta. They say they're symbolic of standing up to power. They also wear them to protect their identities, to remain anonymous. To their supporters, they're freedom fighters or digital Robin Hoods. Among the crowd, the Palestinian flag, and supporters of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, jailed in the UK.
As you've seen with Julian's case, it's the judiciary system. The whole system is corrupt from the roots. You have political prisoners. You have a war on the free press and independent journalists. I know a journalist here who's been arrested before just for filming the police, their criminality. We're not. If anyone thinks we live in a democracy, they really need to wake up. We're not in a democracy. Democracy has several pillars. One of them is free press. One of them is the right to assemble, free speech. All of these are dead.
The mostly peaceful Million Mask March started in 2003 and has grown bigger in number. A grassroots group that says it aims to shed light on government corruption and protect liberty. Saeed Purza, London.
The United States has approved a potential weapon sale worth hundreds of millions of dollars to Saudi Arabia. On Thursday, the Pentagon said the proposed sale of 280 advanced air-to-air missiles was approved by the State Department in late October. The deal is valued at up to $650 million. The State Department said the sale is fully consistent with the administration's pledge to co-lead with diplomacy to end the conflict in Yemen while also ensuring Saudi Arabia has the means to defend itself. Yemen's Ansarullah movement reacted, saying the arms sales prove that U.S. administration has no real intention to stop the Saudi onslaught on Yemen. This is seen as the first major arms sales to Riyadh since President Joe Biden took the helm at the White House. But such weapons transfer is not limited to the current administration. In May 2017, former President Donald Trump signed a mega weapons sales deal worth $110 billion in a meeting with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Their recent deals have made Saudi Arabia become the largest importer of American arms and munitions. According to a report by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, 1/4 of America's arms exports go directly to the kingdom. The report also says that between 2016 and 2020, Saudi weapons purchases only from the United States accounted for 79% of the country's total arms imports. Many believe the U.S. weapon sales to Saudi Arabia serves no one but arms manufacturing companies.
These are offensive weapons to be used against the resistance in Yemen, so it should absolutely be condemned. And the violation of President Biden promising to lead with diplomacy, and once again, its weapon sales, which benefit Raytheon and benefit the Saudi monarchy, but no one else.
But the United States is not the only country that provides Saudis with weapons. The UK, Canada, Spain, France, Italy, and Germany are among other major exporters of weapons to the Al Saud dynasty. The arms supplies of Saudi Arabia have already sparked global criticism, given the kingdom's devastating war on Yemen since March 2015. Anti-war and human rights organizations have long sounded the alarm over the loss of human lives as a result of the West-backed Saudi aggression on Yemen. It seems the U.S. and its Western allies have no concern for misery the Saudi-led coalition have been inflicting on Yemenis. They are rather concerned about petrodollars they receive in return for those weapons being used in the impoverished Arab country.
Last-minute high-level talks in Paris to avert French sanctions on the United Kingdom did not produce any breakthrough, but both sides have agreed to continue discussions. A dispute over fishing boat licensing surprisingly ballooned into swift threats of sanctions and bans on using French ports unless London backed down. The row only concerns about 200 French fishing boats, some of which may be unable or unwilling to prove that they have not been fishing illegally in UK waters. The extremely low economic impact of the dispute has many saying the affair has become overly politicized, with French President Emmanuel Macron posturing ahead of re-election next spring, and the UK with their own questionable motives.
We see the economic problems the UK is having after Brexit, with shortages of gas and goods that appear rather serious. This dispute allows their government to focus attention elsewhere. But fishermen of both nations always have an interest in finding harmony together and sharing natural resources.
But the dispute does reveal the complex and long-lasting nature of the Brexit secession. Analysts say that as the UK's largest trading partner, the European Union holds the best cards. Tougher customs checks, which have not been implemented since Brexit, could cause major delays for British companies and costs which far outweigh sales of fish. France's Prime Minister recently shocked many when he asked the head of the European Commission to, quote, show that it is more damaging to leave the Union than to stay in it. The openly punitive stance has many saying it's an unabashed method to keep countries in the European Union, not by persuasion, but by intimidation.
The EU still doesn't exclude the use of sanctions, but they have consistently been in favor of more negotiations. Our government has said they will follow the lead of the Brussels. So many French fishermen have a real feeling of injustice and of being neglected. We certainly hope our government will put pressure on London, because we cannot go on like this with major losses.
Many expect Brexit to become a perpetual problem in UK-EU relations. And with France sometimes an ally, sometimes a competitor, but always a neighbor, bilateral relations are likely to get more strained as Brexit solidifies into permanence. Rami Mazahiri, Paris.
Former prosecutor, anti-corruption maverick, and political novice Yoon Suk-yeol Friday won the nomination to run for president of South Korea for the Conservative People Power Party.
The South Korean people, who want to restore fairness and common sense in our society, have chosen me, a political novice. Instead of happiness, I feel a sense of responsibility and duty to achieve a change of government.
Former provincial governor Lee Jae-myung won the Democratic Party nomination October 10th and proposes a universal basic income among several liberal policies.
rooting out unfairness, inequality, and corruption, and making a wealthy country where workers are respected are the clear and stern commands from the public.
Early polling shows the candidates running neck and neck.
I support Yoon Suk-yeol because I think that the government of this country ridiculing people should be replaced as soon as possible because lies after lies continue.
I support Lee Jae-myung because he has gone through very difficult times and overcome everything by himself to get where he is now. And he is open and above board as well as firm.
The two main candidates for president of South Korea, conservative Yoon Suk-yeol and Democrat Lee Jae-myung, clash on a number of issues, including North Korea policy. Lee favors peace-building engagement with Pyongyang, whereas Yoon advocates strengthening the alliance with the United States through regular military exercises. South Korea's presidential election is slated for March 9th next year, with the winner set to serve a single 5-year term. Frank Smith, Seoul.
France has been shocked by a report which found that 20% of all the nation's hospital beds have been closed since the start of the pandemic. That total number of closed beds is twice as many as in 2019. Which also reveals that hospitals have been running at under capacity for some time. Unions gathered to clarify the situation, and they said it's even worse than it seems. The 20% number includes private hospitals, but it's public hospitals which have seen their funding cut almost annually since 2009. As recently as the year 2000, France's medical system was ranked number one in the world by the United Nations. That claim can no longer be made following more than a decade of austerity, and perhaps no group has protested as often in recent years as medical professionals. It's not only the lack of resources which is keeping hospitals underutilized or even closed, but also a lack of medical personnel. Studies show that during the age of austerity, public jobs, once eliminated, are not returning, even in hospitals during a once-in-a-century pandemic. What unions repeatedly accused is that the coronavirus is being instrumentalized by France's neoliberals to accelerate their open and long-standing goal of defunding public services even amid the corona instability.
We have this conviction that the government is manipulating corona because they were forcing the cuts before corona. Only the cuts are now coming even faster. In the middle of a pandemic, hospitals are being closed and services are no longer being offered, from our biggest and best public hospitals to smaller ones.
For public medical professionals, working conditions and pressures have dramatically worsened over the last 20 months, causing many to quit and turn over to the private sector. Unions say many of those resigned posts also never get refilled. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
A year ago, Michael Macy, a barber who lives in the suburbs outside Atlanta, Georgia, was thrilled to help propel President Biden to victory, hopeful that Democrats would move swiftly to tackle policing laws and other big issues. But then he watched his hopes for sweeping changes wither in Washington. Now Mr. Macy's sense of optimism, like that of millions of Americans, has been dashed by the pain of an unending pandemic, by rising prices, by nationwide bickering that stretches from school board meetings to the United States Capitol. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Jack Healey, Audra Birch, and Patricia Mazzai. The piece is titled Trapped in a Pandemic Funk. Millions of Americans can't shake a gloomy outlook. Stay with us for more. year ago, Michael Macy, the barber who lives in the suburbs outside Atlanta, Georgia, was thrilled to help propel President Biden to victory, hopeful that Democrats would move swiftly to tackle policing laws and other big issues. But then he watched his hopes for sweeping changes